This is Icon Art Radio. Alan Cobb, Donna Colby, and me, Bill Teeple, and we're here in the Icon Gallery. And let's see, last week's show was very interesting. I loved it, about the empty core. And we were talking about the linear thinking, logical thinking, left-hand side of the brain, and the holistic thinking, everything held as a whole on the right side of the brain. And we talked about the people that couldn't turn off their radios, and the left-hand thinking people that always had to be engaged in the left-hand activity of the brain, you know, always having to have the TV on or the radio or something to keep that engaged. But I didn't get to say something, so I'd like to say it now. And that's that there's a love affair that goes on between the two sides of the universe. And I think that's what's happening here. And there's also, I think, this love affair and this fluctuating between the left-hand side of the brain and the right-hand side of the brain. And I think that even though they cannot turn off the radio, they sometimes listen to music. And I think that even though people are very caught up in the business activity and the legal activities and trying to make their point and trying to accomplish and all this stuff using their left-hand side of their brain and their logic and their linear thinking and analytical thinking, they love the weekend. And I think the weekend is where they can shut it off to some extent and party or go to the symphony or go to the movies. And those artists in society that they wouldn't want their daughter necessarily to marry provide for them escape and massage of that other side of things. And that the weekend is where they go off with their lover, the other side of the brain. So that's what I didn't get to say last time, and you can run with it now.
Also, we had suggested in that discussion that there might be something wrong with always having the radio on. And of course, Donna made the point that if you are going to have the radio on, it should be tuned to KRUULP 100.1 FM.
Because
anywhere on the globe you can listen to it.
Yeah.
Streaming on the internet.
Yes, and you know, we were talking about the speech center and how it's generally concerned with this left-hand logical linear prose side of life. But even in that realm, there are triggers for, I mean, the quote that I read that started the whole discussion was a prose quote. It wasn't poetry and it wasn't
right.
a painting. And
it
had in its core meaning the thing that triggered off this whole discussion that we had. And in the week between last week's show and this week's show, I found another quote that is sort of a little bit more delightful quote along the same lines. It's from an article that by A.E. Housman about the name and nature of poetry, and he quotes Plato. And Plato said, "He who without the muse's madness in his soul comes knocking at the door of poesy and thinks that art will make him anything fit to be called a poet, finds that the poetry which he indicts in his sober senses is beaten hollow by the poetry of madmen." So that kind of gives a little nitty gritty to the empty center.
Oh,
the
yeah.
empty center is not
You've
empty at
You've come up with
all.
Some good ones these yeah. last 2 weeks.
Yeah, it's this the muses play.
I wrote an essay on playwriting some time back, and the point I was trying to make was that the best plays are written in hollow words. That the playwright has this responsibility that other writers may not have in quite the same way, to write in hollow words, so that there's room for an actor. Because if the words of the character are too complete, if they're really explicit and absolutely correct, then the actor has nothing to work with. You've got to leave gaps in it so for the actor's personality to fill up and for the actor's characterization to fill up. And it's a I guess a slightly different angle on the hollowness, but it's a matter of leaving space, which itself is a matter of not being absolutely explicit.
Yeah, and the actor, in turn, then needs to leave that same area of empty space in his or her gestures and acting ability, so that the audience then
can fill in the rest.
Participate and fill in the rest, and then you have a complete collaboration in happening in that room.
It's sort of analogous to, you know, the evolution of painting from being purely representational and striving for more and more accurate representation to getting to the point where suddenly it becomes clear that the thing you're trying to represent accurately is still not there. It's still not being represented accurately, no matter how accurate you get. And so maybe the effort at representing is directed at the wrong target. And we should be trying to express something inside instead of trying to photograph something outside.
Well, which is why Cézanne's apples became so famous, because he, in painting an apple or a plate or whatever in ways that, you know, like the plate was tipped up, the perspective was funny, it's not that color and all that, it has an indigo line around the outside, whatever he did in his brilliance made the apple contain much more luminous appleness than the most perfect photographic painting, you know, of an
apple. Well, in a way, it defied the medium and thrust something undefinable about the apple into the foreground.
Yeah.
Well, this is the, as I've mentioned before, pretty much the description of the historical sequence of art history moving into the modernist period, which was this very discovery that the surface level of accuracy was not it, and so in further pursuit of realism, you would have to keep going.
Yeah,
and what we've been looking for is the it inside of it, which is the empty core that we talked about last week.
And at any point when artists come in periods in art history, when artists come closer and closer to that empty, full, empty core that is all fullness.
And is all there is.
There is always a chance that at any point along that path, somebody is going to like suddenly branch off to some side and make a hard, small formula out of some part of that. So art history goes along, and then suddenly something becomes a trend, and the artists who are not working from that deep place, but who are sort of imitating the artists who did, create things that sort of look like the ones that the deeper, truer artists produced, but they don't do it. There's something missing, and people go to the museums or galleries and look at those paintings and go, well, I just don't like abstract art because it's not doing anything for me. But it's because there is and Kandinsky pointed this out too, because his place that he came from in producing his abstractions was a very, very deep, very spiritual place, and he saw artists following who were just playing with the surface in some very surfacey way and not coming from anything deeper, not pursuing anything more than just let's see what happens when I do this on a very surface level. And so there's a wide range in art history, at any level of art history, between the artists who are coming from that deeper place and the artists who are just following a trend.
I had another thought too about this concept I brought up last week of getting sort of locked into the left side of the brain because the corpus callosum shuts down as soon as you get really verbal. That we sort of led us to the conclusion that, you know, this intellectual style of discourse can never really get to certain kinds of statements. But at the same time, what's really happening in that scenario is that at the beginning of the scenario, there's an impulse to try to describe something. And that impulse is not coming from the left brain, it's coming from the right brain. And if the person is really balanced, then all the faculties of explanation and you know, verbal refinement can come to the fore. You can fire up the engine to its full, you know, steamy monstrosity and express that original thought and then let go of it. And that's what typically doesn't happen, is you've summoned so much energy to make the first statement that then you sort of want to hang on to it. And I think it's the tendency of all the physiological systems to sort of try and maintain themselves. Once they get cranked up, they want to just keep going, and they resist change or being shut down. But really what's perfectly possible is that you make this super refined intellectual observation in pure language, and it has no feeling behind it, but it has the feeling as an inspiration that triggered it. And as soon as the statement is made, you're done. Mm. So the essay is only one paragraph.
But that's a mind and heart that's in balance, and this is what we're after.
Yeah, and when I said that just then, I stopped. I actually made myself no longer embellish it, because it's like, you know, you tend to keep saying. Well, there was a moment of
silence.
Beat
it to death.
Right.
No, but what you're describing is the way things go. Mm. We have an idea that comes up, and then that is able to sustain a while, and then people sort of take the surface level of it and repeat it, and then we have a crystallized sort of an emptiness that has to be broken down again by some sort of coming through with a new way of saying things so that a fresh cognition of truth emerges, and then the people then start to basically worship the surface level of it, and that goes until it breaks down, and it's just the way knowledge moves.
Well, and to circle back to the Plato quote about the madness of the muses, what that is referring to is that part of the creative process that's just this side of the empty center, where there's that whole undifferentiated wholeness that is what Thomas More called the empty center, and then that gives rise to the impulse to create something out of that, like the impulse of the nature spirits or, you know, any element, fundamental intelligences in nature that create life. And there is a kind of madness about that, in that it can go anywhere. That's where all possibilities come from. And so you may, at that point, when you start to create from that level, you generally have no idea where you're going, but you have to jump in to that process, to that, you know, creative energy, and find out what happens.
Well, I think this is mysterious, I can't explain it, but I think that there's an angle taken from the absolute. There's an angle taken from that empty core. Mm-hmm. And then the all possibilities which exist around that, and that the universe is structured in, begins to interact around that angle. So it's all of the dynamic archetypal forces that structure the entire creation begin to do their thing in the context of the angle you've taken, and that's where the artist begins. And it's like, I think if you're sitting in and I've often compared the studio to the cave, you know, where you're leaving time and space as we know it behind 2008 and Fairfield behind, and now you're beginning to, and you go to that silent place, that all possibilities place, and you start to stir stuff, and it's like all possibilities, all places in the mind that you could go. So it is a kind of mad place, and to be able to actually stand your ground and stay plugged in to that silent core, and then sort of stir it. It's really a magician's activity.
Yeah, and that goes back to what you were saying before about then linking the both sides of the brain or both sides of life that have to work together to actually then produce the work of art. What? Because I've been teaching classes on color, what I'm finding is that a color, any color, can be that first impulse for me. If I go into the studio and just like, I'm feeling filled with intensely saturated turquoise today, and I put that down on the canvas, that will give rise to something else. It may give rise to something very concrete, an image that comes up. It may give rise to a pattern. It may give rise to another color. But if I'm authentic enough and brave enough to just like take a blank white canvas and just slash on the turquoise to see what happens, then I enter that magical world, and then something does continue to layer and play with it and, you know, whatever, and keeps on going. But at the beginning, I don't have any idea what that turquoise is going to give birth to.
Yes. Well, you're giving birth to the, you're a birthing creative, you're being a creative force, and you're giving birth to the turquoise, and that sets in motion all this interaction of archetypal beings, really. I mean, the turquoise itself is an archetypal being. And then there's like this realm of the archetypes, this realm of the gods, we might say, where you're situated, mm-hmm. in the gap between the empty core, as you described it, or as Thomas More described it, and the surface level of life. You're down there where all the archetypal forces that generate creation are working.
And that's what draws the muses.
That's the realm of the muses. That is the realm of the muses.
You know, they like to be in that
right.
atmosphere. And then, so you don't feel like, I can't remember which artist said it, but something about I'm never solitary in my studio, you know, because I'm I'm always there with the muses and with all the impressions of everything I've ever experienced and everything else.
Right, a regular Dead Poets Society. Now, I often think of that. I mean, that's my description of my experience in the studio.
Yeah.
Is that I'm not alone, but I'm disconnected from all of my everyday relationships and life activities. But I'm sitting there with all the artists that have gone before. I feel like they're alive with me, mm-hmm. and they're my friends. All the artists that have gone before and gone through this particular, that have been on this ray of the one intelligence and have dealt with life in this way and have trodden this path before me are there with me. And then all of the possible, when we talked about, I mean, the madness is in that you've got the positive forces, the negative forces, you've got it all at hand. And my opinion is that you don't want to hold anything at bay. You want to invite all of the forces to the party. And that way I can be separate and I can be a conductor in a way. I can give it this direction we're talking about without being, you know, trying to keep certain things out. You know, you want to invite it all in and see what happens when you set a direction going without any preconceptions about how it should turn out. No conditions. Mm-hmm. Setting no conditions, and this is a little bit of what we were getting at, I think, in the last... Setting no conditions and bringing no conditions to the viewing of the piece as a viewer, right, is a very important element here.
Yeah.
Did you use the expression "the ray of the one intelligence"?
I'm sorry.
Did Why I sound are you like sorry? A new age no, I don't be it. Sorry. I just
exactly
thought
that, what I said.
That phrase just leapt out at me as because it just sort of ran right over it, and I thought, wow, that was an interesting.
Well, I often use statement. This term to describe being an artist because mm-hmm. I've described what I've attempted to do in my lifetime and as a teacher. To create the archetype artist, mm-hmm. an artist with a capital A, the artist, yeah. and everything that's included in that
Orpheus.
Ray of the one, the yeah. artist ray.
Orpheus.
Now, I just as you were saying that, for the first time in this recording session, I noticed that the background is behind your chair is a painting of a face that is kind of emerging from this like dark background, and your head is right down as if it's a perfect element in that painting. It's like if the artist had painted a head just like yours in that corner of the painting, it would be still a perfect composition. And so it was hard for me to even listen to what you were saying a few minutes ago, because suddenly you became part of that painting. The colors and everything just totally worked for so. Someone ought to actually take
so
a photograph of you sitting
into
in
that,
that
spot. Right brain hemisphere.
Yeah, I think in future we'll have to take the paintings down while we're recording the radio programs.
No, I think we just have to take photo. I think you just have to, after we're done recording the show, someone has to take a photograph of Bill sitting.
Well, I was.
Right there
I was. There's a view from where I'm sitting, where there's the intersection of several planes. And the shadow of the painting behind you is exactly the same white value as the edge of this panel in my foreground. Mm-hmm. And if I line them up so that they're just touching, you can't tell that the panel doesn't go all the way to the edge of the painting, because the shadow and the panel merge. And when the shadow and the space between the shadow and the panel are the same width, it looks like two very deliberate vertical stripes which were put there for some reason. So I took a few photographs while Bill was talking and while you were talking of that sort of confluence of angles and shades and things.
So it's you'll only have to shoot from her point of view before
I'll have to go over and take pictures.
Take a picture, Bill. Well,
we're lapsing into the, we're really going into that art world here today.
Yeah,
well, and
that's
it's done on radio too, because the radio audience has no idea what we're referring to.
Right, but it's an exact illustration of everything we've talked about in the last couple of shows of not being able to stay isolated in the right brain.
Yeah.
If you're used to functioning in this other
yeah.
realm. So we're in the radio show. I mean, this is kind of a nice dance that we're doing in these two shows, because we're bouncing back and forth from explaining things in a verbal way and entering these other funny
Well, we can all just be silent and let everybody imagine the show.
Yes. Now, we should make loud breathing noises so that people know that the radio is still on. The well, station hasn't drifted away.
My son Dane actually has a show
right.
on KRUU yeah. on Saturday mornings at 10 o'clock where he does exactly that. He'll have
yeah.
just found sounds and, you know, pieces of music and interviews. And he interviewed my mom, my 87-year-old mom, his grandmother, for two shows. And just had her telling whatever stories popped into her head, and he just played them interspersed with some pieces of music and sounds and all. And I listened to those two shows and actually got to know my mom in a different way than I normally mm-hmm. perceive her
uh-huh.
from listening to her through Dane's ears and in the context of the way that he put together his show. It was fascinating.
It's always interesting to hear someone, excuse me, to hear someone relating to someone else than to you.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily by eavesdropping,
right,
but
right.
It's always, I remember, you know, when I was traveling around with Maharishi for years, and it was so intriguing to have a reporter come in and sit there and ask other questions just sort of come from a place that didn't include knowing anything at all about Maharishi or what he was trying to get across. And to hear these questions coming out of left field and hear how Maharishi responded to them. And it's been the same thing, you know, listening to candidates being interviewed by different kinds of interviewers. Mm. And you see a little bit of it through the eyes of the interviewer.
Yeah, and people, there are also interesting experiences where someone who you normally see at close range, you see them doing something at a distance or mm-hmm. in a group or something like that, and you see their form in a completely different way. It's just, yeah. That's always been an interesting thing to me, too, almost like a performer on a stage. And I guess in... even more dramatic is when you see yourself in a film.
Yes.
The first time I saw it, somebody made a film of me one time when I was in my 20s, and all I was supposed to be doing was walking through an abandoned building, you know, and it was an art student who was doing mm-hmm. some kind of little artsy thing, and it was a short film, and I watched it over and over again because I just couldn't believe that I actually moved that way. Mm. It wasn't the way I thought I moved. Like when you hear your voice on tape
Absolutely.
For the first time, you know, think that's how you sound.
Yeah, I've spent most of my life adjusting to what I really look like to people as opposed to what I thought I looked like and spoke like and all. I mean, I had a very distinct idea of who I was as a young person. It was a lot more some heroic than what the actuality is. And I've adjusted to, this person that I see up there. And since I do a lot of recording and video kind of stuff where I see myself, I've really come to know that person. I've kind of gotten to know that person and understood that person looks like that. But it's a really interesting, it took some time. And now I sort of think of myself as that.
Well, and who we see inside has more to do with that full empty center than the features of our body anyway. So it may be truer, our inner perception than what the mirror
this is
says.
If we do another show next week, which we will, I've got some ideas for that one.
Okay, great.
Listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.